This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Hello and welcome to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Dashrin Johan. The Johor Sultan, Ibrahim Sultan Iskandar, has been sworn in as the 17th Agong for a five-year term. His deputy is the Sultan Nazrin Shah of Perak. So in light of that, on today's episode, we're going to be taking a look at what exactly the role of the monarchy is according to the constitutional framework of Malaysia. Joining me on the show is Niu Sin Yu. He's a constitutional lawyer. Sin Yu, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thanks for having me again.
So let's start with just understanding how our society is arranged according to the constitution. What is a constitutional monarchy?
Constitutional monarchy is a monarchy, but he exercises his powers based on what is there in the constitution. And in Malaysia, the YDPA is a Yang Di-Pertuan Agong is a constitutional monarchy, which means that he is the head of our federation. He is also the head of Islam in eight states, the four states without a hereditary Malay ruler, the three federal territories, as well as his own state. And he is also the commander-in-chief for the Malaysian Armed Forces. I think this is not highlighted enough.
Right.
But he is the commander-in-chief. But I think above all, he is the symbol of unity for our country. Hmm.
Could you explain the process of royal succession in Malaysia?
Well, Malaysia is unique in that we have a rotational elected monarchy, and I think this is the only type of its only kind in the world. So under the federal constitution, Article 38, the Yang Di-Pertuan Agong and the deputy YDPA, they are elected by and from the nine rulers of the Malay states for a period of 5 years. So these nine rulers, they form the Conference of Rulers. There is an election process, and this election process is governed by Schedule 3 of the Federal Constitution. There are certain conditions to be met in order to be qualified to be elected as the Yang Di-Pertuan Agong, and a ruler is qualified unless he is a minor or he notifies the Conference of Rulers that he has no desire to be elected, or the Conference of Rulers in a secret ballot decides that he is unsuitable to be elected, either by reason of infirmity of mind or body, or any other causes. And in order for the Yang Di-Pertuan Agong to be elected, there must be a majority. That means five needs to vote in favor. There is also a process where they follow an election list. So the position of the Yang Di-Pertuan Agong, it shall first be offered to whoever that's first on this election list. This election list, it started off with the most senior being the first back in 1957, but I think now that has changed. I'm not sure what the list is now, but they had started off with the seniority, and I think there is that element still there. I should probably also note, since we are on this topic, that the Yang Di-Pertuan Agong can actually be removed by the Conference of Rulers if a majority votes in favor. So that, in summary, is the process by which the Yang Di-Pertuan Agong is elected.
So you touched on this a little bit in your introduction, but what is the role of the monarchy according to the constitutional framework of Malaysia? What are the formal powers vested in the Malaysian monarch?
Well, this is a topic that, you know, keeps coming up given the political instability that we have experienced in the past few years. But what would be interesting to do is to bring up this oath that the YDPA takes when he assumes his position, and it's quite telling once you refer to that oath. And I don't think this is something that people or the public is aware of enough. And the oath goes something like this: the YDPA, he solemnly and truly declared that he will justly and faithfully perform his duties in the administration of Malaysia in accordance with its laws and constitution, which have been promulgated or which may be promulgated from time to time in the future. Further, the YDPA do solemnly and truly declare that he shall at all times protect the religion of Islam and uphold the rules of law and order in the country. So that gives you a pretty good idea of the role of the monarchy based on our constitutional framework. But to be more specific on certain points, the YDPA, like I mentioned earlier, he is the head of state. So this means that high commissioners from Commonwealth countries and ambassadors or other diplomatic representatives from foreign countries, they will be accredited to him. And like the oath mentions, at the end of the day, he is a constitutional monarch, which means he acts on advice on most matters, but he retains discretion in limited matters, and some of which it has come to life, it became apparent, where you have situations of hung parliaments, unclear majority. So the framework is demarcated, is there. His powers are demarcated by the constitution, but it is also beyond that.
Right. So would you say that the YDPA only has ceremonial powers, has a mixture of ceremonial, when I mean ceremonial, I mean like symbolic powers, and or would you say, yeah, or it's a mixture of ceremonial and also formal powers, and what are the limitations imposed by the constitution on these powers?
Well, he certainly has ceremonial powers in the sense that yes, formal powers where he cannot exercise those powers without advice. So he cannot do it on his own accord. But he does not only have ceremonial powers. There are certain powers which he can exercise on his own discretion, in his own discretion, that is there in the constitution. So maybe what would be useful is to give an idea of, or a summary, a very quick summary of his powers, and then we take it through what is formal and what is powers which he can exercise in his discretion.
Right.
And there are many. There's a lot. I think there are hundreds of references of the Yang Lieutenant Agong in the constitution. And it concerns all aspects of government. You have the executive, the legislature, the judiciary, even the election commission, the armed forces, and even Islam. But I would highlight a few important ones.
Yep.
The Yang Lieutenant Agong has the power, and perhaps this is the most important power, to appoint a prime minister to preside over the cabinet. And this needs to be a MP who, in his judgment, is likely to command the confidence of majority of the Dewan Rakyat. Now, some may say that this is a ceremonial power. Yes, when there is a clear majority. So when there is a clear majority, a person, usually the leader of the biggest party, has 112 seats in the Dewan Rakyat, then yes, the Yang Di-Penanggong has to appoint this particular person because his party has won the election. So in that sense, no discretion there. But where it is uncertain, and it has been uncertain for a number of times in the past, in 2020 and 2021 and even 2022, where it was uncertain, then his discretion comes alive. So those in those situations, he has a personal discretion to basically make a judgment call of who in his judgment, who in his mind is likely to command confidence of the majority. And I pay particular emphasis on the word likely because it is an uncertain situation. He may not be able to say for certain that this person has clear majority, but what he can do is that he can say, okay, I'll appoint you as prime minister. Now you go and test your majority. And there are certain conventions governing the exercise of this power, but I won't go into that. But that gives you a very clear idea that the role of the Yang Di-Penanggong is not purely ceremonial, where I think Tun Mahathir once said that, oh, his job is to sign. but as we can see from the constitution, that's not the case.
Right.
So that's one part, yeah.
So, Senior, I want to dive into the contemporary politics and the realities on the ground a little bit in the second part of our show. But from a constitutional perspective, can the monarch participate in politics and governance of Malaysia?
Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that he is an indispensable part of government. Government in the sense that he is the head of the state. So he plays very important functions in the executive, in the legislature, and in the judiciary. So, and he has the right to receive information from government under the constitution. And he also has the right to express his views to the Prime Minister and the Cabinet in the exercise of their duties as Prime Minister and the Cabinet. So in that sense that he is in government. But I suppose what you're trying to say is that whether or not he should be attributed to the failings or the successes of governments,
right,
which is quite intertwined with politics. In that sense, no, because he must remain above the mud of politics. And as we know, government is driven a lot by what is politically expedient. So that's when the demarcation between what is his formal power and what is his discretion it comes in. So when it comes to exercise of purely executive function, like for example budget, passing on a certain bill, or I don't know, subsidies, what's the hot topic these days, those are things which the YDPA does not play a role in.
Right.
He may receive information and he may express his views, but ultimately he cannot do anything because that is something that the government must do and advise him if they need him to exercise certain powers. But otherwise, he plays no role. But when it comes to certain decisions, for example, where the government makes that requires his input, like for example, things pertaining to privileges, things pertaining to Islam, things pertaining to the rights of Bumiputra, then yes, under the constitution, he does play those roles. So it depends. I'm sorry, I'm giving you quite a roundabout answer, but the role is not simple.
Right.
But I think the underlying principle is that the monarch, being the head of state, being you can call him an umpire of sorts, even though it's not really that.
Right.
Perhaps an umpire in certain situations, but being the symbol of unity, you don't want to descend into the mud of politics, because politics is inherently divisive.
Right.
So if the monarch descends into politics, takes political sides, express political views, then there is a risk that he would be tainted, and that wouldn't be good, because as a symbol of unity, you wouldn't want to do anything that is divisive.
Does the Constitution tell us anything about what the role what role the monarchy can play in the realm of business?
No, the Constitution doesn't say anything about the role of the monarchy in the business. But I think that's needs to be put into context, because the Constitution doesn't say many things.
Right.
It doesn't say Malaysia is a democracy. It doesn't say that we have separation of power, you know, but these are principles which we hold to dearly. And I think to answer this question and to really understand what the monarch can or cannot do, it's important to be conscious of the Yang Dipuan Agong's role as a constitutional monarch. Like I mentioned and kept repeating, you know, he's the head of state and symbol of unity, so he must remain untarnished and above the proverbial mark. If you talk about business, it can be, no pun intended, dirty business, you know.
Right.
So even though the Constitution doesn't make any mention of the role of monarch in the realm of business, like some of the other part of the constitutions do, where it holders of high office, for example, it does make mention of those not allowing to hold office of profits, it's silent for the monarch. So, but I think it's the same principle like politics. He must be careful to not allow the dirt of business to taint his position and institution. Other monarchs and other royal families, I think in other parts of the world, they do have business interests, they do have assets. So again, it would be quite ignorant to say that the monarch, he must divest himself from all business interests. I think the reality is far from that. But he must be careful to not let this business interest to taint his position, to taint himself. And it's also worth reminding that the Yang Dipuan Agong, the monarch, is not immune. So business oftentimes leads to disputes, leads to litigation. Although one would say that it is an unequal bargaining power, but because he is not immune and there is possibility of dispute, you wouldn't want a situation where the monarch faces a court case where he has to be meted in the special court that's constituted under the constitution. So there are many considerations. It's not a prohibition, but I'm sure the monarch is smart enough to navigate through this turbulent waters and stray away from the controversies and the mud.
Let's go for a very quick break. On the show with me today is Niu Sin Yu. He's a constitutional lawyer. We will continue this discussion after these messages. Keep it here on Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9. Wow. Welcome back to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Dashran Johan, and on the show with me today is Niu Sin Yu. He's a constitutional lawyer, and we're talking about the role of the Yang di-Pertuan Agong in Malaysia, and Malaysia is a constitutional monarchy. So this conversation will also be available on podcasts. You can look us up, Beyond the Ballot Box, on Spotify, the BFM app, or wherever you get your podcasts from. If you are listening to this on Spotify, I would really appreciate it if you gave us a follow or drop us a review. It would be really helpful. So, Sin Yu, how does the Malaysian monarchy differ from constitutional monarchies in other countries, say the UK, for example?
It is both very similar and more so in recent times, very different. And it's very similar because much of our practice, our conventions and what's there in the constitution really, it is derived from the UK and the Commonwealth. Although a lot of conventions that is there in the UK, it's not actually captured in the federal constitution. So in that sense, we are very similar. We do follow that Westminster and British model of a constitutional monarchy. But I think more so in recent times, we are different in the sense that we have started to create our own practices. For better or for worse, I would like to think for better, but better doesn't mean that you can't improve on it. But for better, some practices which we have adopted in that is different from the convention there in UK. So I think one such example is what had happened in 2020, 2021, and 2022, where the practice of ascertaining who is likely to command the confidence of the majority, where the Yang di-Tuan Agong, he requested for statutory declarations, and on top of that, he interviewed, I think, each member of parliament to verify their support. So I think that's something that is quite different. But I would like to think that that is something that is good, because the Yang di-Pertuan Agong, he has, in a way, done his due diligence rather than blindly believing politicians. Well, we know how that goes with politicians.
Right.
But it is a good practice because it's not there in the UK. In the UK, I suppose they have a decent check system where you are expected to do the right thing. You shouldn't mislead the monarchy. But you know, in Malaysia, that's probably not the best thing to do. So I think Prof. Shad Paruki, he likes to describe this as it being a Eastminster style of government,
right,
of constitutional monarch, which I find quite interesting.
Right.
And it's not without without cause, requiring to do this due diligence, because as we have seen that in the past, especially during COVID time, where the Yang di-Pertuan Agong had to express his I think dissatisfaction at certain things which the minister had done, you know, pertaining to the, if I'm not wrong, the emergency. So what is being presented to us, the public, as well as what's being told to the Dewan Rakyat, sometimes it may not be an actual reflection of what is the truth. And I thought certain conventions that we have now developed as our own, it is perhaps fit for purpose for our country and our democracy. But that is to say, that doesn't mean that it can't be improved on. Ultimately, the Yang di-Pertuan Agong, the monarch, shouldn't be placed in a position where he has to make judgment calls. He
right.
has to basically be the umpire and select who he thinks is going to command the confidence of the majority.
And that's what I want to ask you next, because I can't remember the last time the swearing-in ceremony of an agong in Malaysia received this much attention. And I think a lot of it has to do with how politically polarized Malaysia is right now. So there's a lot of curiosity on the role the YDP is going to play amid this polarization. And indeed, like you mentioned, right, since the fall of Barisan Nasional in 2018, and particularly after Langkah Sheraton, the monarchy has been unceremoniously sort of dragged into our political mess. And the politicians have made him a sort of umpire during these times of political deadlock and instability, where the agong has had to make judgment calls. From a constitutional perspective, how do you view this? And how important, given contemporary politics, the reality on the ground in Malaysia today, how important is it to have the monarchy? You know, how important of a role the monarchy, you know, plays when it comes to bringing about political stability in Malaysia, especially over the past few years? How important have you seen this role to be?
Whatever that happened in 2020, 2021, 2022, it was unprecedented, at least for our nation. We had three different prime ministers in the space of 3 years. And no election. So given the circumstances, I thought the Yang Ditan Agong then did an excellent job navigating through this unknown waters. And like I mentioned earlier, where there is a situation of unclear majority, that is when his discretion comes alive. He was very careful in his decision-making process. This is a very important role, because if assuming that he, which didn't proven later on proven didn't through the government being able to pass bills in parliament, but assuming that he had got it wrong, then we would have a situation where government wouldn't function. By asking for SDs, by meeting each MP to individually confirming their support, even though not revealing the actual numbers, it worked because each prime minister that was appointed, they successfully managed to pass bills in parliament. And usually passing bills, especially what we commonly call as confidence bills, like for example the budget or a major policy bill, that's a indication of whether or not the prime minister enjoys support or confidence of the majority of members of parliament. And for Muhyiddin, for Ismail Sabri, that was proven because they managed to pass through the budgets and major bills. So in this sense, of course, his job could be made easier if amongst the politicians, they could agree amongst themselves who is going to be prime minister, who's going to form government, confidence and supply, I don't know, think of something.
Right.
Rather than going to the man and saying, oh, I have majority, and the other person also say that I have majority, and you put him in that position. I think that's a bit, not a bit, that's quite irresponsible for political leaders to do that, because what you're achieving by doing that is that you are putting His Majesty in a position where His Majesty could be dragged down into politics. You're asking him to make a judgment call effectively. So in that sense, that's not something that should be repeated by political leaders. And since I'm on this, I should also add that other thing that we often see political leaders do is that they tend to use the monarchy as a shield in defending some of their decisions or some of their policies.
Right.
which is not right, because His Majesty is a constitutional monarchy. You're supposed to advise him and then do what you need to do, rather than saying that the monarchy, I'm doing this because the YDP told me to, or this is the YDP's decision. It's what you're doing is that you're putting him in an awkward position, a position which he shouldn't be in. So in that sense, to answer your question finally, that during 2020 to 2022, he has been a stabilizing factor, in the sense that he kept government going, kept government functioning. And don't forget the emergency, where he refused to call for an emergency, and then the second one, he agreed to it. So he kept government going. He ensured that we have leadership in place. And at the same time, unfortunately, he has also been used as a shield by politicians, where I suppose you could say it prevented attacks or aggravation by political opponents. And that, you know, you would say that, yeah, in that sense, the Yang Bintang Agong has been a very important factor throughout this whole really turbulent period. And maybe I should just conclude this part by saying that whether or not how important the monarchy is in bringing about political stability in Malaysia over the past few years, that's something that cannot be answered legally. And it shouldn't be answered legally. And that's something that I suppose it depends on which lens you wear. If you're wearing a political lens, yeah, perhaps you could say that it is important in bringing about political stability. But if you are like me, where you wear a legal and constitutional lens, I would say that it is not the role of the monarchy to bring about political stability. Political stability is something that needs to be agreed and achieved by politicians. The monarchy is a symbol of unity. He should remain above that.
Something very profound the YDP had, and I think a couple of months ago he said it, he wasn't the YDP at then, he was prepping to become the YDP. And he said that he's not going to be taking a back seat. He's vowed to fight corruption, ensure unity. Now, this is a great signal narrative-wise. We definitely need to clean up our country. You know, it's rife with corruption, and it sort of coincides with the Prime Minister and his Kerajaan Madani's sort of mission to clean up the country as well. But what role can or should the YDPA play within the framework of our constitution when it comes to corruption, fighting corruption, and so on and so forth?
There's many layers to that question, and there's also many layers to that to the answer. But it is important to remind ourselves that the role of monarchy, it's something that is quite hotly debated in the past few years. And I think this, well, clearly it has something to do with the end of Barisan Nasional's political hegemony. So the king and the conference of rulers, they in a way came in to fill this void, you see. So in other countries, you do hear monarchies expressing or giving certain messages to the public. I think in England, you hear the Queen or the late Queen used to have Christmas messages, or when there is certain events of great national impact, people yearn to hear from the monarchy. So it is not unusual for the monarchy to send a message or express his views to the public. But again, it goes back to what is the content of that message. If that's the content of that message is political, then you, of course, run the risk of being dragged into politics. So in that sense, whether or not it was proper, I think that was the question, right? Whether it was proper to express.
The question is more, it's not whether it's proper to express, but because I think His Majesty has all the rights to express what he wants.
Yep.
I think it's more of how can he, you know, if he wants to combat corruption,
What role can he play
within the framework of our constitution? Yeah.
So the role that he can play, it's actually there in the constitution. He can receive information from the government and he can privately express his views to the prime minister. So in that sense, if corruption, it is a serious issue in this country, it is something that His Majesty can express to the prime minister, albeit it's always in private. They consider that communication to be privileged and in some ways sacred, the communications between the monarchy and the prime minister. So I think most prime ministers do tend to take the views expressed by the monarchy quite seriously, because the monarchy is, after all, somebody that is very loved by the people. So you do run a great political risk if you don't heed the call of the monarchy. So in that sense, yes, there is a role that the monarchy can play, but to expand, to go beyond that, that becomes problematic. Simply because look at how the corruption cases are being prosecuted, being investigated, and being tried in the courts. You get political mudslinging on both sides. And there is a political toll in bringing these cases, especially against politicians mm-hmm. or those who were previously in government. So to expand the monarchy's role of combating corruption beyond what is there in the constitution, effectively what you're doing would be to risk, again, putting the monarchy through what is unnecessary political mud. And if corruption is not effectively combated, then what would people say? Oh, His Majesty has not done his job properly. You know, you don't want that. But I don't think the monarchy would do that or go beyond what's there in the constitution, because the repercussions are real and the damage is long term. But of course, constitution being the constitution, sometimes people don't follow, right? That's why you have cases of constitutional breach of the constitution. But I think it's important that we all hark back to what is basic principles, that the monarchy is a constitutional monarchy, and I'm sure the Conference of Rulers is acutely aware of that. They're also acutely aware of the fact that let's not descend into politics. These politicians, they are bad news.
Right. You know what, Sinew, our country, when it comes to our constitution, if a prime minister and his government has two-third majority support of parliamentarians, two-third majority support in parliament, then you can make changes to the constitution. That was how Undi 18 came about, and so on and so forth. I'm wondering, with regard to the monarchy, with regard to the YDPA and so on, have there been constitutional amendments concerning the role of the monarchy over the years? If so, how many amendments have there been?
Yes, there's been two major... Sorry, I think just two amendments.
Right.
That affected the rights and privileges of the monarchy. I think one was in 1983, 1984, where they amended, I think, can't remember the article, it could be Article 66, but it relates to the power to ascend bills. So previously, there was no time limit to ascend bills. To put this into context for those who are not in the know, all bills passed by Parliament must be presented to the Yang Ditun Agong for royal assent. Previously, there was no time period which the Yang Ditun Agong is required to meet before he assents the bill. But the 1983-1984 amendments, it introduced a time period. I think initially it was 15 days, now it's 30 days. So now, even if the Yang Ditun Agong does not assent to a bill, it will be deemed to be passed as though as it has received assent. And I think in 1994, this was the famous or rather infamous removal of their immunity and the establishment of special courts. So of course, this can't be done without the approval or the agreement of the Conference of Rulers. So yes, two-third majority is required, but I think the agreement of the Conference of Rulers is also required. I won't go into the politics of it, but that's right. The legal side of things.
Absolutely. So just before we wrap this conversation up, we are a constitutional monarchy, Sinew. How can we, within this framework of constitutional monarchy, ensure that there are adequate checks and balances so that all the various institutions, can be held to account, can be held accountable, there's enough transparency, so on and so forth. Are there any policy improvements we need or amendments that we need to do to ensure there are adequate checks and balances?
The role of the monarchy is in itself a form of check and balance. Although it's a check and balance that should be avoided in the sense that it shouldn't be called to check or balance. For reasons that that I've explained right. earlier many times over, but it is an important role, and what needs to be realized is that when you have a situation where you have a very strong executive, or you have a situation where you have a very delinquent executive. Assuming that they bulldoze certain unconstitutional amendments to the constitution, or they push certain policy which are quite clearly adverse to the Muslim religion or the rights and privileges of the Malays, then you would the Yang Ditun Agong to, well, basically express his dissatisfaction and halt or in a way resist such acts by a very irresponsible executive. So in that sense, the role of the monarchy is there for perhaps as a safety net of sorts for situations like this. But if we were to reach that stage, then you'll be a testament of the failures of the democratic public, as well as the executive, as well as our other branches of government, because there's so many remedies when the executive acts out of line. You have the judiciary, you have the legislature, they want to be checking on the executive. So to have all that fail, and then you have the Yang Ditun Agong as the last line of defense. Yeah, I think that'll be quite a sad day.
Sinew, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was New Sin Yu. He's a constitutional lawyer. This conversation will also be available on podcasts. You can look up Beyond the Ballot Box on Spotify, the BFM app, or wherever you get your podcasts from. I'm Darshan Johan, and this has been Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.